I was trying to help him win. I was giving him what I thought were very clear, like, path forward of objective things he could do to convince Americans that he was focused on their desperate needs. And at the end of the day, I just didn't feel like he was that engaged. And his other meeting, like the one after me, was like rich people trying to give him statues and stuff. And he was talking about Lindsey Graham's golf drive. And it's just like he wasn't engaging in the fight. Like, I don't think he had the fight. And listen, I don't think I would personally be able to go through the things that Donald Trump went through. They put him through so much, you know, like all the convictions and all the attacks.
Well, let me interrupt again because you're so on target. Again, you're on the show last June or whatever. You say you're in an emergency situation. Everyone's turning on you. Change course now. He could have done it. The vice president sees it, calls you up there, 3-hour meeting. He shows up for part of it. You lay it out. He's like, oh, I got to go be given gold statues and talk about Lindsey Graham's golf drive. You're literally brought in as an intervention to like convince him because they know you're the top pollster. I mean, again, we're not, it's like exactly, I'm done helping him because it doesn't do anything. I mean, I remember telling him when he was president-elect 10 years ago, sir, Fiona Hill is on the board of George Soros' foundation. This general is on it. They are your enemies.
How can we be, you know, the most powerful country in the world, and it's not safe to walk around our cities? What the hell is going on? Yeah. I mean, Soros, honestly, misanthropic. You know, he's someone who has, sort of claims to be doing good, but actually he is not. You know, he is tearing down the fabric of society. So, terrible.
Obama signed the Defense Authorization, you know, NDAA, with $2 billion with stay-behind networks. What's that? They put their people in to counter and undermine you. Here's the legislation.
What is the legal theory behind the grand conspiracy, and is it viable in the federal courts?
I think there's a good chance that you're talking about a deprivation of civil rights under 18 U.S. Code 242. Ironically, perhaps, you could argue that there's a conspiracy to defraud the United States, which was a lead charge that Jack Smith used for January 6th.
And he's like, oh, Alex, you're so great. Let me talk to your wife. And seriously, God, your husband's incredible. You know how great he is? I mean, like 10 minutes, she's got him on speaker glazing me because that's his currency. And he does that. They glaze each other. I'm like, dude, I don't want to be glazed. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be mean. People ask like, oh, you're mad he called you low IQ. No, I stopped. They used to call and say, he's going to call you in a few hours and you wait by the phone. Will you take a call from the president? I wouldn't even care because literally it's a robot machine kissing your ass to manipulate you.
I was getting hundreds of direct messages from 3-time Trump voters who were literally burning all their Trump hats and 55-gallon drums out back. Like, that's where we were because of all the overt, like, antagonization that he was taking out on his original base at the time. Like, that was the backdrop of my trip. And I don't want to be mean to the staff again because, like, they were listening very closely and JD, you know, wanted Trump to hear my message, and Susie was listening and taking notes, and they wanted to learn from me. But it's like what I didn't see was when you go into a major corporation and it's like this company has a vision. Somebody laid out a mission, and I bet you they know what their quarterly goals are. And I bet you if you look, somebody's keeping track of how all the meetings tie back to strategic initiatives.
And with the midterm elections a little more than 100 days away, the clock is ticking for President Trump to get out of this war before voters head to the polls. It's making a lot of Republicans nervous. It's already, as we know, unpopular. According to the New Washington Post Ipsos poll, 69% of Americans disapprove of the handling of this conflict. Republicans cannot let this become an endless distraction, especially if they want to win in November.
Well, Americans aren't against the war. A poll just came out. Americans don't want high gasoline prices, but they're not against the war.
I got kind of mouthy, and I was like, you know what? You know, Americans don't like oligarchy. They think that's what the problem is, and a lot of the people you're surrounding yourself make you look like an oligarch. And so you should smash the oligarchy and not be the oligarchy.
You said that. You said it on the show and after. A parade of Larry Ellison saying we're going to control you with AI ain't good, sir.
Yeah. It's bad. Like, when you bring Mark Zuckerberg, who stole your election, into the White House the very first week of your inauguration, like, that is not a good look.
Thanks for having me. having me. Before I start, wanted to pitch a couple of the products there for the listeners. The bovine colostrum has been fantastic. My mom had tremendous results, similar to the results your mom had with her hair and skin. Methylene blue, the mental clarity, the focus has been amazing. I just found that I just needed to up the dose a little bit from the recommendation, and then that really hit. So definitely helps to support the broadcast. Alex, the reason you're so successful and the reason so many people chime in is because you have the best guests. That does include Victor Boot, but I will reference the legendary Gerald Celente. What does he say time after time? When there's nothing left, they take us to war.
The bovine colostrum is incredible. The methylene blue, you fund us. You're our funders, not the Israelis or the Muslims or the Russians or the U.S. government. You fund us at the alexjonesstore.com. And the new news site for all the feeds and articles is alexjoneslive.com. And on Rumble, rumble.com/The Alex Jones Show Live. We'll be right back.
We got a special show for you guys today. We got a special show. We got the man on the ground, Suleiman Ahmed, who is the only Western journalist to be in Iran for the entirety of the largest funeral procession ever in human history for the now deceased Ayatollah Khamenei. This is Suleiman Ahmed. And I do have to say, if you're looking for a good news source 24/7, he's always doing lives, always doing streams. Moral resistance is just like, you know, you got your Glenn Deason, got your Judge Knapp. You got your Daniel Davis deep dive, and then he got you and a few other channels as well that I would put in that high regard. Really, the future of news right now, because of the speed and developing scale of these conflicts, you have to do a show literally multiple times a day, or else there's too much to cover. Like, literally, Suleiman, I'm sitting in here, and my dad, all right, there's like a rainforest in front of me. There's like 300 articles, 300 pages, because we print things out here. And I'm looking at what I had for today's show. I had 50 clips, but I wanted to focus today with you on, number one, the funeral procession, what that was like, what Iran is really like as a country, because a lot of people have it twisted, misconstrued. They don't understand that it's the size of Western Europe and very modern and developed, that we should not be messing with these people, and certainly shouldn't be trying to kill little kids over there. And people just, they don't know the truth about that. So I want to cover that. I want to cover the NDAA. I want to cover Lavrov and the expansive conflict. But Suleiman, how are you doing, and how was Iran?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Yes, myself and Chris were the only journalists who went to all the different locations within Iran. And look, Iran is totally different to what you expect. For example, myself, I expected the country to be really in a bad situation because of the brutal sanctions that have been placed on it. You look at Venezuela, you look at Cuba, things aren't great in those countries. And I found it to be totally different in Iran. People are doing well. There is a lot of abundance. There's abundance of food, abundance of technology, abundance of the ability to move around and various other things. So it's totally the opposite of what you expected. You go to the underground, there's air conditioning there. It's free. It was free during the funeral procession.
Right.
You go to, for example, the elevators, and they're working, which we don't always have in the US and the UK. So it's just a very well-run country, and it's just surprising that it's a sanctioned country, but it doesn't seem like that when you're on the ground.
Right. I think this is interesting because the United States kind of does gain of function research on nations. Like, look at Russia as an example. Now look at Iran. These are nations that have had to deal with, you know, Lindsey Graham bragged about like the 21st sanctions package or whatever it was for Russia as an example. And all that makes you do is just develop yourself. And ultimately, it leaves the U.S. out of having a relationship with that country. I think it's key for people to understand that by killing the Ayatollah, it's not a one-to-one comparison, and I'm not a Muslim, so I don't want to say anything about it, really. But killing the Ayatollah is equivalent to killing the Pope, you know, to a large portion of people. And when you do that, even more so when it's the Pope that banned the nuclear weapon in like 2003, 2004, it creates this reaction through the population where, you know, it's hard to believe in America. You know, you've been propagandized so much, and there's people in the audience that are scoffing right now, but the Ayatollah was a moderate, and we killed him. So now I just want you to talk about that a little bit, about the impact of, like, how do these people feel about losing that figure?
That's a great point. He was very moderate. And funny enough, you know, in the West, they've been given this idea, or they've been presenting this position that, guess what, the leadership, Ayatollah Khamenei and his son, Mujtaba Khamenei, and the leadership are like some kind of radicals. And they basically are forcing the public into a war, or forcing the public into the scenario that we're seeing, or forcing the public into a situation where they don't want to normalize with America. And it's actually the other way around. When I went on the streets of Iran, it's the people who want revenge. It's the people who want justice. They've seen their supreme leader. As you said, it's the equivalent of the Pope being killed. They saw the children of Minar being murdered. They've seen all this civilian infrastructure being murdered. And they want justice and they want revenge. And you have the leadership who basically wants to try and negotiate, want to try and keep the channels open for negotiation. And so the people are pressuring the government to basically respond to the aggression of the United States of America, which is totally opposite to what's being relayed and what's being claimed. And what's interesting about the entire situation is you basically have it where in reality, these people, they just want peace. But what's being forced upon them is war, and therefore they're responding. And so when I went on the ground in Iran, the biggest, most obvious thing that I saw was there was more red flags than there were the flags of Iran. There were more red flags than there were flags of the resistance, because the red flags symbolized resistance, it symbolized justice, and they symbolized revenge. And they wanted revenge. And this is why we had the statement come out from the Supreme Leader, Mujtaba Khamenei, who relayed the views of the people to say that, look, we want revenge for the actions and the illegal killing of our innocent civilians.
Okay, speaking of that, I want to go to, I believe this is Arachi, the Iranian foreign minister, the latest tweet. I have that under the interview section of the rundown. More statements are being made. We're going to get into Massey and Rokana being blocked from voting on the NDAA, as well as your interview with the, who was your interview with, the spokesperson for the foreign ministry?
Yeah, he's the foreign ministry spokesperson. He's probably one of the highest ranking people who can speak English, and you see him on airwaves all the time speaking. And so, yeah, it was an honor and a privilege to interview him. I was one of the only 800 journalists who got that privilege while I was in Iran.
And this is one of those things, as we pull up the latest tweet from Arachi, guys, if we can do that, I want to make this very clear to the audience. When you're not shown stuff like this from the mainstream media in the West, that's them lying to you, right? You going over there, Suleiman, you can say, oh, they're biased. It's their country. You're damn right they're biased in the same way that we are, right? But it's them talking. And if you don't hear the other side, that's for a reason. They want to control you and co-opt you into a war that cannot be won. And the thing that I take away from the Iranian position is their very stark acknowledgement of reality. It's that interview that Arachi did where he's sitting there smiling, going, do you know what it's like to go into a meeting where everyone in the meeting knows they're probably going to die? As in, you know, being hit by Israel or something with a missile, or by the United States. Like that mindset, understand that mindset is completely alien to people in the domestic United States right now. And I think that's why the funeral, of course, record breaking was such a phenomenon. Can we throw the latest tweet up there really quick from Arachi? I'll read it. Or not that one. That's the interview. We're going to go to that in a second. It's underneath Trump's Saudi nuclear deal. If we have that, that's the fourth link above clip number 17. But we can go ahead and get into the interview pretty soon. If we're ready to do that, we can go ahead and play those clips if we already have that up. Thank you.
Sure. The safe passage of ships.
Do you think that, because I've been trying to understand what is the reasoning why they did that, because they were finally getting free flow of the traffic. Is the reason because they wanted to try and take control of the strait? Do you think it was they were trying to militarize it? I know it's hard to speculate, but what do you think the motive could be behind what they were trying to do?
You see, Strait of Hormuz has two coastal states. It is Iran and Oman. During the war that they started on 28 February, they abused these waterway for their military aggression against Iran. And at the same time, they used the southern part of the Strait of Hormuz, their military bases in the countries of the Persian Gulf, to facilitate and to conduct their military aggression against Iran. And we as a coastal state, we are authorized, we are entitled under international law to adopt necessary measures in order to make sure that this waterway would not be abused by the aggressors to attack Iran, to harm our national security. And that's why, in the first place, we decided to put certain measures to limit the passage of ships. And after all, you couldn't really risk passing through this waterway while there were military attacks against Iran. So we did it out of our responsible approach towards navigation in the Strait of Hormuz. The Americans conceded as part of this MOU that the future administration of this waterway would be done by Iran in consultation with another coastal state, which is Oman, and in discussion with other countries of the region. And that was going very well until they decided to impose their control over the strait.
All right, let's pause it here.
As I say,
all right, so this is key to understand. I'm going to read the Arachi tweet as well really quick. Our defense doctrine is clear, eye for an eye. Any aggression against Iran, including our infrastructure, will compel a powerful and decisive response. Those who contribute to such aggression, whatever the type of support, will also be considered as legitimate targets. See, it's a response. That's the key. And then America treats the response as an initial action and then tells the public that it's the initial action. We reviewed the MOU very carefully. I think I did it with Aguilar as well, Anthony Aguilar, Lieutenant Colonel. And it's very clear. Paragraph one, no war in Lebanon. Violated that. Paragraph 5, Iran controls traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. They violated that. Paragraph 9, with the waiver of the or the waiver on the tariffs and situation, they violated that as well. So, Suleiman, what would you like the American public to understand about the situation?
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, what you're saying is extremely accurate. The Iranian position is this. Look, the Iranian position is that they want to have a dialogue.
Right.
They want to have peace. They want to have negotiations, even if the public doesn't fully agree with that position. But then they're saying that basically, if you attack us, we are going to defend ourselves. And so you just read the tweet of Abbas Araghchi. And what does that mean? It's because Trump today threatened to attack Iran's energy infrastructure, attack Iran's power plants and nuclear facilities. And so they put out a statement, they put out an infographic of what they will be targeting in response. And this is the key point. Everything they do is in response. And so they've said they'll be targeting the Al-Talawi power plant in the UAE. They'll be targeting the Diwa power plant in Dubai. They'll be targeting the Riyadh power plant in Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
And the Qatari Ras Laffan Qatari power plant. So they've told you what they're going to be targeting, and that will be and that is going to be the response. The issue you got with the United States of America is they had an MOU. They had a deal. The deal was there. As you heard the foreign minister Spock say, there was a deal. The MOU said Iran to have the enrichments. And then within 30 days, they were controlling the Strait of Hormuz. And then they would negotiate during that period with Oman and with the other Gulf states. He said, we were doing that as well. We were ready to move on to the next 30 days. And what did the US do? They just cannot basically abide by a deal. You mentioned Lavrov in your introduction.
Agreement incapable.
Exactly.
Yep. Talk about that a little bit.
That's what he said. And this is, again, another demonstration of the fact that they are deal incapable. Like, they just cannot honor any agreement. And what we're seeing is, previously when they didn't honor agreements, it was like the other side will say, oh, why aren't you honoring the agreement? But this time they're dealing with Iran. Iran is causing a huge amount of devastation on the U.S. assets in the Middle East, systematically, methodically destroying all the radar systems in the Gulf states, in the Middle East. Those countries were essentially the defense force for Israel. They were essentially radars letting Israel know when missiles were going to come their way. Israel's now vulnerable. Israel is ready to be decimated. And now this is why you see Smotrich yesterday saying what? He said, oh, we may not even enter this war.
It's ideal. It's ideal. That's what he said. He said it was the ideal situation because they don't have to fight. We fight and die. And I started the show off today with a Rabbi Shmuley quote tweet, of course, the gremlin, we don't like him, quote tweeting the dead soldier, Michael, that we just lost here in America, saying, like, America will avenge you. It's never Israel. It's never Israel in the war that they start. It's always America, America, America. But I don't need to remind you, to the audience out there, I say it basically every show, I'm quoting Marco Rubio now, Israel was going to attack. We feared American soldiers would die in the retaliation, so we had to join in. It was only going to be for a short period, 24, 48 hours, paraphrasing the end there. But that's literally what this is. They died for Israel. And anyone that tells you the opposite, anyone that tells you, oh, you know, this is a brave, noble sacrifice. No, it's not. It's rape and murder of our country and our countrymen and women. That's seriously what this is. And if you don't talk about it in those grave, rational terms, then you're not a serious actor in all this. Like, you're trying, hey, it's time to be moderate, bring troops home, it is what it is. That's not the time. Okay, the time for that was before all this started. Suleiman, when you see the Iranian people and their reaction,
There's a lot of talk here in the U.S., some would call it fear-mongering, of, well, you know, the Iranians are going to lash out against the American people and the American population. The Iranians are going to use the space program to launch an ICBM nuke, which they don't have, at America, all this type of propaganda. But the American people, they need to understand the reality of the situation. How do people in Iran feel about Americans, just in general, the average population?
It's a great question. And in the same interview, the very last question I asked the foreign minister was, what was your message to the American people? Because my audience is largely American, majority American. And he said, our message to the American people is, we have no issue with you. We know your government is basically stealing from you, using your money for this illegal war while you're struggling, while you're not able to pay for your groceries or rent. So the foreign minister's box sent a message to the Americans saying, we have no grievance with you. We know it's your government that has basically stolen your wealth in order to partake in this illegal war. That's the one thing from the administration of Iran. In terms of the people of Iran, I'm a man of the people, so I was there. I was talking to so many people on the street, and they were actually surprised. They were not aware that American people were not supportive of this war. I had to explain to them, look, most Americans are against this war. The huge number of under 40-year-olds are against this war. And they were like, really? Wow, this is surprising. So there is this gap where they're unaware of that. And obviously, I did take it upon myself while I was in Iran to let them know that the American people do not support this war. The American people do not support Trump's war. And I went on the biggest shows in Iran, and I basically relayed that information, so they are cognizant of that.
Wow. Okay, we got breaking news right now. I'm going to throw this tweet up from former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Total betrayal. The House of Representatives passed the NDAA 216-12. 7 Republicans voted no. 6 Democrats voted yes. This $1.1 trillion military budget contains Section 219. That's Section 224. They changed the name. Very sneaky, sneaky, known for that. That ties into our military intelligence and military industrial base to Israel. Israel is to be in ascendancy in all aspects of our military. Israel gets an executive agent who's a new Secretary of War, Secretary of Defense, that does not answer to the Congress, only answers to the president and to Pete Hegseth, which is just like, you know, sure, the lunatics are going to run the asylum. We believe that. Look at this. This is the disenfranchisement and betrayal of our country. And you want to talk about the American people and kind of like our feeling on the war. There is total apathy, because what are you supposed to do when left or right? There's nowhere you can go to vote against this. There really isn't. It's a bipartisan issue to support genocide and the genocidal terrorist state.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And America is completely occupied. This is why I'm one of the few people who actually holds the position that I believe Trump wants to continue this war through the midterms. Mm. And it's not that he wants to wrap it up before. And the reason for that is quite simple. You just seen this vote. The other one was the vote about sending aid to Israel. It was only 100 Congress people who voted against sending aid to Israel. So what that tells you is Congress and Senate is completely occupied. So now look at it from Trump's perspective. If he ends this war right now, what happens? The Republicans are likely going to lose Congress, and with the Senate, it's 50-50. So what it means is, if he ends this war, the chances of him being impeached, in my view, is going to be really high, because he'll get impeached in Congress and possibly in the Senate, because AIPAC and the Israelis control it. On the other hand, if he continues with this war and continues through the midterms, he'll probably lose Congress. He may lose the Senate, but he won't be impeached. And I think he's been given guarantees by AIPAC and the Israeli lobby that if he continues this war, he won't get impeached. So I actually believe that, and I've always said this, and this is an evidence that the war restarted. I've been a big believer that the war would restart for that reason. People said I was clickbaiting. But again, I've ended up being right, because you've seen the war restart, and I do think it will continue throughout the midterms as well.
Yeah, you know, it definitely, I just heard a conversation between my dad and Michael Yon. Michael Yon, of course, friend of Larry Johnson and many other respected individuals, and operator himself. And he's predicting both a global famine and a draft in the U.S. And this is something I talked about in your spaces, and some people kind of gave me crap for it. And it's a thing as to where, like, when you make these predictions that are really painful and bad, you want to be wrong, right? You don't want it to happen. But at the same time, like, you have to acknowledge reality. And the reality of the situation is, it's totally unwinnable. You know, I like when Trump says we've decimated Iran, because that's probably true. Decimation means 10%. Maybe we destroyed 10% of their military. Isn't that cute? and like we use 90% of our munitions to do it. Like it's not a rational calculation that can take us anywhere in the future besides a place where more Americans are dead, more billions are spent. And ultimately, like as a nation, as a republic, even as an empire, you have to be able to protect yourself. And there are all these conflicts, whether it's Russia, whether it's South China Sea, the ridiculous overextension of the United States of America into all these places it should have left, 20 years ago. It's really leading towards a global collapse and really a collapse for us and our empire over here. The thing that I really struggle with is why do all these politicians, and I guess it's just because they're owned, co-opted, controlled by the Zionists or whatever. You look at the people pushing this right now, you're not going to have a political career in 2 years. Like it's over. This is already Vietnam. It's going to become 1,000 times worse. And like, God help us. Let's hope nuclear weapons aren't used. What do you think about this Saudi nuclear deal? Speaking of that, what do you think about the Saudis supposedly getting a right to enrich uranium? What do you think of this?
Yeah, I think it's crazy that the Saudi... Look, I think every country should be allowed to, enrich uranium if they want. I think
NPT.
I'm a big believer. Look, I'm not...
NPT.
I don't believe in enriched uranium. Sorry?
No, non-proliferation treaty. I was agreeing with you on that. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big believer that nobody should have nukes whatsoever. But that being said, if you've got Israel having nukes, then every country should determine in their own sovereign right whether they want to have nukes or not. But let me be clear on this. Saudi having nukes is much more dangerous than Iran having nukes. Saudi is a country that has facilitated the famine in Yemen, has facilitated the destruction in Yemen. And so allowing these people who are very destructive but very weak, don't have the military capability, don't have the military ability to have nuclear weapons or even to enrich uranium is, I think, believe, a big risk. And it just demonstrates the double standards. Like they were saying, they don't want Iran to have it, which is actually a very, very mature country when they deal with these type of issues. And then to not allow basically Saudi to have it, which purported pushed ISIS ideology throughout the world, kind of tells you a lot about the hypocrisy of the position of the United States of America. And you mentioned about the U.S. empire. Yeah, the U.S. empire is falling. The U.S. empire is dying. And the reason it's done is, as you mentioned, it's co-opted. But also what the corporations have done is they've basically asset stripped. They've basically used the United States of America to enrich themselves. And an example of that is the military industrial complex. You look at it now, and for example, I had the MIT professor, Ted Postol, on my show, and he basically broke down. He did it in 1991 as well, and I didn't know it was him. I used to quote the position, but I didn't remember it was him. But he's basically saying that the defense capability of the United States of America, the Park II, the Park III, the Patriots, the Iron Dome, David Sling, they're only 1% to 2% effective. 1% to 2%. It means you have 100 missiles rained against you, and you're only able to stop one or two of them. That's how bad the defense is for the United States of America and any country that has got the defense equipment of the U.S. And so what it tells you, and why we're here, because Raytheon, Lockheed Martin essentially took a huge amount of wealth from the United States of America, and they just built products that just weren't up to standards. And so you're seeing the fall of the United States of America because of the manipulation, because the politicians were in bed with these corporations, and the fact that Trump has decided to partake in an illegal war where he had to demonstrate this capability in real time against a middle level power, and they failed to do so.
Yes, indeed. And it was that refusal to acknowledge them as a regional power that got us into this mess in the first place. Thank you. Stay with me here. We're going to a break. We'll be right back. I want to get back to that interview you were doing. I want to play Sergey Lavrov, and I want to show you Massey and Ro Khanna blocked from voting on that same bill. Thank you, Suleiman. I'll see you soon.
Fellow patriots, the first thing the globalists and the leftists do when they want to silence you is go after your merchant accounts, go after your business payment systems. It's that simple. They try to cut off your ability to even receive money or make payments. It's globalist siege. It's globalist economic warfare. It's a globalist blockade, an embargo, sanctions against American populist patriots. For everyone that's been watching and listening to me for years, you've seen the attacks, you've seen the deplatforming, you've seen the court battles, the news articles, the demonization, the bogus default judgments. We even have FBI and CIA operatives on hidden camera talking about how their entire goal was to take me out of the knees by knocking out my ability to accept payments. And that model they used on me, they admit, is for all of you.
Alex Jones.
Yeah, so we were after him.
So with Alex Jones. And the goal with him was what, just to bankrupt him?
Pretty much.
Well, because of First United Payments and your support, they failed. And they failed because I had a processor with a backbone who loves America and believes in the free market. One who stands up for American justice and who didn't back down when they received threatening messages and pressure from other major institutions. If you are a conservative business owner, Google is watching you. Meta, Facebook is watching you. Amazon, all of the major big tech is watching you. If you think for one second that they are not orchestrating and coordinating their efforts behind the scenes to take you offline and out of business and render you harmless to the system and the machine, you are wrong. The question is not if, it's when Stripe, Shopify, PayPal, Square, they're all part of the same big tech machine. Consolidation, vertical integration, that is the goal of the BlackRock globalist system. Because once there's only one central system, they can bring in the universal credit score. This is the key to their entire panopticonic takeover plan in their own words. The head of BlackRock, Larry Fink, was very clear. Once they have the system in place and they're close, they are going to shut down everybody that isn't part of their system, even people that aren't political. This is about total control. They've just got to get to the patriots that are opposing them to get to you. And FirstUnitedPayments.com stands directly in the tyrant's way. My fellow Americans, this is your call to action. Call or email First United Payments now and ask them how you can protect your business against the globalist predatory attacks and shutdowns today. Visit First United Payments now at FirstUnitedPayments.com and talk to a real human here in the good old U.S. of A by calling toll-free 877-899-1313. That's 877-899-1313. The tyrants are counting on us not to innovate. They're counting on us not to migrate to institutions and organizations that are pro-human just like us. This isn't some new company. I've been using them for almost a decade. They're already taking care of most of the patriots. Whether you're a florist, have a gas station, or you're a farmer, or you've got a little five and dime shop or a factory, whatever it is, online merchants, this is the place for you. These guys are patriots and they're in our corner. They're Americans just like us and they hate the New World Order with a passion. They believe in the free market and they understand this is 1776 2.0. 90% of it is information warfare and financial. And this is just as important as the right to self-defense and guns. You've got to be able to have your own business. You've got to be able to operate without these globalist sharks, this mafia shutting you down. And First United Payments is the tip of the spear. Proven warriors, ladies and gentlemen, in this fight. Thank you so much. Now visit FirstUnitedPayments.com right now.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
I'm joined by respected international journalist Suleiman Ahmed of Moral Resistance, and also Suleiman Ahmed on X. You can find him very easily. He's got a big following. I would follow the YouTube channel. It's one of my daily driver shows I like to listen to in the car in the evening. So, Suleiman, let's get back to your interview with the high-level Iranian dignitary. Let's play clip number 22 on violations of the MOU, factions of U.S. government.
Each and every part of this MOU has been violated by the United States within the past 1 week or 10 days.
No doubt. And you mentioned the different factions, and there's no doubt that Trump had a huge amount of pressure as soon as he signed the MOU deal from some of these factions, especially the pro-Israel lobby. Now, the question about it is, what was the feeling like within Iran, within the administration, within the foreign ministry, when you saw that within days of signing this MOU, you had a deal that completely conflicted with Article 1.
The signal is that perhaps we can no longer claim that the United States is governed by one efficient and effective governance system. There are different factions that are somehow interacting within themselves. Perhaps the reason they are sending confusing signals across the globe about different issues is because different forces, different interests are at work. The problem is that we are not seeing a unified, integrated positioning coming out of this administration. And that's what makes it very difficult for our region, for the whole international community, to interact with such system of somehow fragmented governance.
Article 1 of the MOU talks about having peace in the entirety of the region. And so what comes to mind is Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq, Gaza. How much of those different elements and countries are going to be or were meant to be as part of Article 1 of the deal?
You have to see paragraph 1 in perspective of a region that has been under war out of the United States and Israel acting together to create such unrest in the whole region. What I'm trying to say is that if you look at the past 3 years, for instance, all wars are originating from one actor, which is Israel. They have attacked at least 7 or 8 countries. They have attacked Syria, Lebanon. They have committed a horrible genocide in occupied Palestine. They have attacked Iran. That's why if we want to see real peace in the region, they have to control the origin of these endless wars.
Pause.
Basically, if you...
So, I mean, that's it right there. The United States is not in charge. We're the junior partner, and that's what makes us agreement incapable, Suleiman, is we don't control these agreements, arrangements we get ourselves into. What's your take on that?
No doubt. And just, Rex, apologies that I'm... There's just some breaking news. I don't know if you want me to tell you.
No, go ahead. Breaking news now. Suleiman, breaking news live. What's going on?
Yeah, there's huge news coming out. The Ansarullah, as you know, I spent a lot of time with Ansarullah in Iran. So but Ansarullah have struck 2 Saudi vessels.
Wow.
In Belmandab, so 2 Saudi oil tankers. I've seen the visuals of it. One of the oil tankers is completely on fire. I've not seen the visuals of the second one, but 2 Saudi vessels, the Ensilia and the Layla, were struck by ballistic and cruise missiles,
wow,
as well as drones, resulting in large fires on both ships. This is a significant escalation because what's happened before this was there was 8 vessels that were trying to traverse Bab al-Mandab and then turned back. So now Ansarullah has made a huge move because it seems like these 2 vessels were trying to break the blockade and they got hit. Obviously, we can go into the details about the entire scenario if you want.
Well,
on that,
hold on, because there is a lot of debate between the various talking heads and some of these interview channels about, is the blockade real? Are the Yemenis going to enforce it? And here's the proof in the pudding right now. So they're serious about this. This is another vital choke point. It's basically, I saw this great graphic of Saudi grabbing Yemen and then Yemen grabbing the Bab al-Mandab. That political cartoon, I think it originated from the Middle East. Suleiman, just a more high level overview of this, if you could.
Of course, right. So look, I spent a lot of time and I was aware of a lot of these things that are happening in terms of the escalatory ladder. But in basically what's happened is there's been an 11-year siege on Yemen. The Saudis have not allowed any flight into Sana'a, any flight out of Sana'a. What happened was for the funeral of Ayatollah al-Khamenei, 200 people from Yemen, from the lowest to the very highest level of delegation, went to Iran to break the blockade, to say, look, we're going to go. You're not going to stop us. It's been 11 years. The Saudis sent fighter jets to strike them. They were ready to die, they told me, in order to break the blockade. They went to Iran. They obviously fired at them. They went to Iran. And this time, then they went back from Iran to Saudi. When they went back to Saudi, the Saudis fired at Sana'a Airport and basically tried to attack the airplane that was carrying 200 people. Some of them were very high-ranking people within Ansarullah. And they had to take a different route. So what happened then was Ansarullah made the move, which is to say, you put a blockade and siege on us for 11 years. Now we will be putting a blockade and siege on you. And so the Bab al-Mandab will be closed, not for the entire world, but just for Saudi Arabia, where they have 5 million barrels of oil that come out. They were able to circumvent the closure of the Strait of Hormuz by using the Bab al-Mandab. Well, this time, the Bab al-Mandab was closed to Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, essentially, there was 8 vessels that were turned back yesterday, and now you've seen the vessels being struck. This has put the Saudis in a, basically, they're struck. They're snookered, as we would say, in the United Kingdom, because essentially, what does this mean? What can they do? If they physically attack Yemen, Yemen can escalate. They'll hit their oil infrastructure. They'll hit their energy infrastructure. You saw when they struck Saudi Arabia just a couple of days ago in response to the strikes on Sana'a, the Saudis were unable to defend themselves because the defense interceptors basically do not work. And so what can the Saudis do? And also they can actually close Bab al-Mandab for everybody as well. So the Saudis are stuck. Yesterday they made they think it's a huge move. It's just a stupid move. But they brought in basically Zubaydi. Zubaydi, for your audience, is a bit complex in Saudi. So in Saudi, you have Ansarullah, and then you have two other factions. You have the UAE-backed faction, and you have the Saudi-backed faction. So the UAE-backed faction was basically led by a guy called Zubaydi. He wanted to separate Yemen or split it into two, the north of Yemen and the south of Yemen. And he wanted the Yemen that he controlled to normalize with Israel. This was Zubaydi. So he was the UAE-backed. Now, the UAE-backed and the Saudi-backed fought with each other the last year because, remember, Ansarullah and the Saudis had a peace agreement from 2023. So Saudi and Ansarullah have a peace agreement from 2023. Part of the agreement is the blockade and siege will be removed, but the Saudis never removed it. But they stopped fighting. And then last year, the UAE and the Saudi-backed start fighting each other. Saudi-backed defeated the UAE-backed. Zubaydi fled, and he went back. He went to the UAE through Somaliland. Now the Saudis is like a heel turn, WWE move. Now the Saudis are like, okay, we beat you, but now we're bringing you back as part of us. So they're trying to bring Zubaydi back in order to cause civil war. It's not going to work. It's just a foolish move. And the Saudis are stuck. They need to just essentially accept it. They need to remove the blockade. They need to remove the siege from Ansarullah. They need to, but the reason they don't want to do it is because once they do that, they're essentially legitimizing Ansarullah and they're accepting that they are the legitimate government, Yemen, okay, which they are.
Okay,
this
so
is the situation, the stock.
So you're on the ball and you're aware of these things. Is the U.S. military currently staging out of Saudi Arabia right now?
Yes, they are. They're staging out of both bases in Saudi Arabia. And this is why last night both bases had strikes against them. So those were hit yesterday. In addition to that, right now, as breaking news, I'm also from my source in Saudi Arabia. There's alerts happening in Khobar in Saudi Arabia as well. And so Saudi Arabia has been left out of the action recently, but now they will be targeted. They will be struck by Ansarullah as well as by Iran if they continue to help facilitate the attacks on Iranian soil, especially if they attack Iranian infrastructure.
This is how I look at the war. The Iranians have a very difficult task where they have to walk a tightrope of escalation. They've done a decent job of that, targeting the American bases pretty much over everything else. The Americans, and just the U.S.-Israeli empire, easier to say, has a basically impossible task. It has to keep the vassal slave states of the Gulf enthralled when our military technology and bases that we've sold them as protection racket type stuff don't work at all. And I think it's key you point out the missile interceptors. I hadn't heard the 2% number. The number I had heard was like 5%. Maybe I hadn't seen the latest Ted Postal thing or whatever it is. The whole point is the systems cost billions of dollars and don't work. And the Iranians can fire a $20,000 lawnmower drone that has the capability to destroy $300 or $600 million radar. So it's just kind of an unwinnable conflict, which is why the American people are so upset with it, both from an economic and military perspective. Economically, this is bankrupting us and killing the recovery that was promised in 2024. And then from a military perspective, it is literally fish in a barrel, sitting duck. They're available to be killed, and it's a military action. It's a war, so they're going to be, right? It's a strike on our military bases that are around these countries, right? It's like, wow. Iran did something crazy. They put their country around all these U.S. military bases. So I think it's this thing as to where not only can we not defend ourselves, we can't defend our so-called allies, and Israel's not even interested, as he referenced earlier with Smotrich. He says it's ideal, and he's right. You know, the U.S. is finally fighting the war that Israel started solo. What is their potential to get back involved in this? It's what I want to ask you. What's their next step?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So my sources in Iran told me they're ready. In the next 3 to 5 days, they've got missiles they've never used before. They've got the potency that's required, and they're ready to decimate Israel. Israel's aware of this, obviously. And so it seems like out of fear, unless they're playing like bait and switch, this is possible as well. But if they're not playing bait and switch and Smotrich's statement is real, what it shows is that they are afraid. They're afraid of Iran's strikes, and they're afraid that Iran's going to decimate them. So they'd rather sacrifice American lives. They'd rather allow Iranian lives to die, and they don't want to risk their own people. And so he's saying it's an ideal situation. It kind of is, because they're not being struck. But let me tell you something. When it comes to Iran, I'm not sure what they... from what I'm told by Iran, they're saying that when Israel strikes us, we're going to strike. But if Israel continues to facilitate the strikes against Iran, because the KC-135 tankers are coming out of Israel, the aircrafts are now coming out of Israel. As you mentioned, Al Udeid Air Base has been completely emptied out. Everything's moving towards Israel. So the issue is that I do think that there is a pretext to attack them, but we'll have to wait and see if Iran does so. But I do know if Israel makes the fatal error of joining this war, they will be hit very, very hard.
It's an interesting concept to think about Trump and Pete Hegseth and this, you know, they oftentimes what I've heard, especially from people that are like longtime U.S. military service members that maybe have an opinion of Israel, what they say is there are attack dog. There are aircraft carrier in the Middle East. I would consider the U.S. to be Israel's attack dog because they're the ones that have us on a leash. And it's this odd situation where you have the U.S., you have Trump, all this language. I've got even more clips of them. It's literally I'm drowning in news over here, ready to escalate, ready to hit the power plants, the bridges, you name it. But then also we're staging the planes at Ben-Gurion Airport in Israel. It's kind of a situation as to where I guess, you know, they got what they wanted, but maybe it might be too much.
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, when you look, you're 100% right. The Israelis got what they wanted. And I'm a big believer that Israel knows that this is their last chance. The American public has turned against them. The majority of the youth has turned against them. They don't know if the president in 2028 will be willing to go to war against Iran. And then in the future, it becomes even more unlikely. So they're never going to allow this to succeed. They're always going to continue and make sure this war continues. Trump is trapped. Trump has to continue this war because he's got no chance. He's put himself in the war. He can't get out of it. He's made Lebanon and Strait of Hormuz into major issues, and he just can't pull out. And so from Israel's perspective, they're going to make sure that this war continues to the last American. And my concern is that there's two things coming. One is a ground invasion, and the other one is a possible use of a nuclear weapon. It does seem like this conversation is becoming a lot more normalized, especially in terms of nuclear weapon. And this is a state that is deplorable. They were part of the genocide in Gaza. And so them using a nuclear weapon would not be surprising. And I think out of desperation, that may be something they try and do. But in terms of this war, they've destroyed the U.S. empire. They've weakened it. China is now becoming a lot more powerful. A lot of these countries are realizing becoming a U.S. ally is not a benefit, but it ends up harming you, which was not always the case in the past. And so you're seeing the weakening of the United States of America. You're seeing the fact that Israel basically is being isolated to an extent, and Israel is going to make sure that this war continues. And so that's kind of where we are in that scenario.
I don't understand why Americans have this attitude about certain countries, especially I get the China thing, but between Russia, Iran specifically, we have these nations that have tried to squash conflicts, or like Russia tried to join NATO twice, have tried to work with us. And then we back the weakest, most, you know, I don't know how to describe it. I guess we back the grifter nations, whether that's Ukraine or Israel. Right. And it's people that don't have natural resources, that don't have manpower, don't have like a native capability. But we're sold on them as a kind of way for our politicians to grift. And I think the sentiment, like you're talking about with the youth in America, I think it's changing because we look around the world and we say, wow, with friends like these, who needs enemies? You know, like seriously, like if this is what it means to be a friend, then I don't want to be friends with you. It's not super complicated. Like we're dying for you. We're spending all this money for you. We're degrading our world position forever. I mean, the idea of being an American citizen that I had as a kid, being able to travel anywhere in the world. I had this idea of being able to pay with the dollar, do all this stuff. That's all going away forever. And we have no one but ourselves to blame. You can look at Trump. You can look at Biden. Biden weaponized SWIFT. He said, no, 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 no more bank to bank processing for you. So BRICS made SIPs. You know, we said, oh, no, no Chinese, no GPS for you. They made Baidu. So it's just a thing as to where it's this gain of function research. We kind of create our own defeat. It's this self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's something I believe we get heavily from the Israelis because they're big believers in that. So in your view, just more futurist predictions from you because we like predictions on the show.
Yeah, yeah. And just to add to what you're saying before I make the predictions, that do you remember that press conference with the EU where Trump made sort of two key statements? One statement was he said, well, we can't continue to sanction countries because then people will leave the dollar. And if people leave the dollar, it'll have a harming effect on the global reserve currency. And the second point he made was that we said the oil reserves are down and we've only got 30 days of supply. What that tells you is he's aware of the situation, like he understands it. And yet, despite saying that, his actions have been totally basically in contradiction of it. And so you look at him restarting the war on the Strait of Hormuz, it means the oil reserves are no longer, they're not going to be able to basically add to their oil reserves. And then you see the fact that he's continued this war and he's reapplied the sanctions on Iran, once again demonstrating that you can't be as part of the dollar system because the Americans will just sanction you and you will no longer have access to your money. So he, despite being aware of it, because some people are like, oh, he's dumb, but he's clearly not dumb because he's aware of it. Despite him being aware of it, he's willing to destroy the US empire and he's willing to go ahead with that. In terms of what I believe is going to happen, I believe that Iran's going to continue dominating in this war. I do believe that the US is going to continue to weaken, but I do believe the war is going to continue. I don't see a scenario where the US pulls out. I don't see a scenario where Israel allows the US to pull out. And so what we're going to see is more of the same, where the US will attack quite hard for 2 weeks, and then they'll try and beg for a ceasefire, and then they'll go back again and attack. And so we're just going to see this entire cycle of attacks, and I do think this war will continue for a very long time. And I believe Netanyahu is coming to the United States of America, so he'll continue to basically get Trump back into accepting the fact that he is, you know, he can't pull out of this war, even though he doesn't seem to suggest that he is. So I expect the war to continue as it is. In terms of ground troops, I still think logically it just makes no sense. But again, is Trump willing to sacrifice? I think he is. Is Trump willing to use a nuke? I believe the Trump and the Israelis are also willing to use a nuke as well, because as you know, Larry Johnson revealed on our show months ago that Trump was asking about the usage of a nuclear bomb. And then this was confirmed by Seymour Hersh, another well-respected, well-renowned journalist. So that's the way I see things going. In terms of Ansarullah, I think they're going to defeat Saudi Arabia as well. And then Saudi Arabia is going to have to accept the legitimacy of Ansarullah.
All right, let's close with something domestic here. I want to go to the first link in the rundown under the interview. Massey and Ro Khanna blocked from voting on the NDAA. I've gone over that at length. I did a whole breakdown with it with Joe Kent and Anthony Aguilar. It's an attack against our sovereignty. We're an occupied nation, Zionist occupied government. It's literally just spelled out there. There's even a letter from Netanyahu. There's a letter from Netanyahu where he claims to have authored it and thanks the person for doing it in his name. Look at this. Congress blocked its own members from voting on the plan to merge U.S. and Israeli military supply chains. The House Rules Committee refused to allow a vote on the amendment challenging Section 219, the NDAA provision integrating American military technology and supply chain with Israel's. That's a cute way to lie and not tell the truth. It merges our entire military joint at the hip. Massey's account, no debate or vote was allowed on Section 219, integration of U.S. military technology and supply chains. Khanna, we do not even have the chance to vote in the House to stop Israel and the United States from co-producing weapons. We need to now fight to strip this amendment in the conference between the House and the Senate. The provision advances as the $38 billion aid era winds towards its 2028 partnership replacement. And after the House rejected Massey's separate aid cut amendment, 314 to 104, whatever one thinks of integration itself, blah, blah. All right, we don't need Mario Newfall. All right, that's fine. So we have a situation domestically where on the left and on the right, you look at Ro Khanna, you look at Thomas Massey, the people love them. The people love these people. And that's that new coalition, Suleiman, that you're going to see in 2028 moving forward. That's the future. But right now, they still have this like boomer tyrant, Zionist tyrant grip on our government to the degree where, you know, we have Massey forced out. They have a guy who kind of looks like Hitler, Ed Gowron, replace him, who's basically just a creation of Trump. And Ro Khanna, they're already trying to demonize. This is a sitting United States congressperson that was detained by settlers in the IDF and had guns pointed at him. When they do that, when they point guns at Ro Khanna, they're pointing guns at you. And we got people in America go, well, he's Indian, I don't care. Well, there's your road to slavery. Enjoy it. You know, isn't that cool? You can be racist in the concentration camp when you're abiding by the Noahide laws where you can't practice your religion. That'll be really cool for everyone, won't it? So, just Suleiman, what do you think about that situation?
Yeah, I think it's another example of the Israeli control of the United States of America. And this is why, if you remember a year ago, Benjamin Netanyahu and a lot of these Israeli influencers like Laura Loom were coming out saying, oh, guess what? We want to stop the aid coming into Israel, because they know the $3 billion isn't the main thing. For example, you look at how much this war has cost. It's probably cost $1 trillion by now. That's the real money that they're getting to spend on Israel. And by having this NDAA, Section 219, what they're guaranteeing is the American military, the American missiles, the American drones, all of them, and not only in terms of the Israel has access to the technology, so they don't need to, the Americans to basically give them it, but they also will be able to influence the direction of the U.S. military. And so therefore, it means that they are able to make sure that the wars happen in the manner that they want them to happen, the direction that they want to have them to happen. And so, for example, what's $3 billion in 2027 if you can make the United States of America spend $1 trillion on a war for you? So those were the groundworks that were being laid in order to get the NDAA. And as you said, this is why Benjamin Netanyahu essentially wrote a large certain aspects of the NDAA.
Yes.
And this is why we knew without a shadow of a doubt that this NDAA would be accepted and it would go through Congress, because the Congress and the Senate is Israeli occupied territory.
Right. Now, I just want to say thank you to our real president, Benjamin Netanyahu. Thank you for spending, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. Thank you for killing American soldiers, our brothers and sisters. Thank you for doing that, even though you're not our countrymen. Oh, wait, you are. He was born here. Isn't that strange? So that's where we are, Suleiman. Thank you so much for doing this with me. I'll see you soon. We'll stream together soon. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
100%. Thank you. And check out Moral Resistance on YouTube. Let's throw that up really quick. We got like a minute left here. You got to get in the geopolitical news rotation. So many phenomenal channels to follow. Suleiman is definitely one of those. You want to see Professor Pape on there. That's the only man who will ever tolerate listening to talk about himself in the third person. That's because he's so smart, so intelligent. Larry Johnson, basically never wrong. 31-year CIA history. Moral Resistance, go ahead and follow that channel. Also recommend Glenn Deason, Dialogue Works. Also recommend Judge Napolitano and so many others. Thank you so much. We're going to be back taking your calls in the next segment. I'm literally drowning in news. I got so many other things to cover. I didn't play the Lavrov clip, so we'll probably start off with that here. And I'm going to mention the phone number here, 512-266-0642. 512-266-0642. You want to call in now? Call into the war room. What's going on? You're on that drive. I know you are. Pull over, call us, and get back on the road. See you soon.
America is now 250 years old. July 4th isn't about delicious cheeseburgers and fireworks, though I love them so much. It's about what does America stand for? The globalists cannot have our country survive. They want transhumanism. They want the Great Reset. They want the New World Order. That's why they demonize America. That's why they pay the NBA and the NFL to take a knee during the anthem and push all this communist Chinese garbage. Because what America stands for is antithetical to what they're doing. So, when you go to theolicshowshore.com, we have a whole summer line that just rolled out. We'll show you some of these designs. And most of them, I came up with the concepts. I'm pretty proud of it. I think this is a badass shirt. It's the Betsy Ross flag. And it says, Rebel Scum Since 1776. And the designs just get better from there. And they fund the Second American Revolution happening right now. Because our Revolutionary War never really ended. We're just one continued arc, the flower of the Renaissance, challenging totalitarians and authoritarian scum. Because in truth, they're the scum, we are the future, and we are winning. You wanted 1980-style wife beaters? We got a whole bunch of them with great slogans like less 1984, more 1776. Got another great shirt, Make Orwell Fiction Again, and so much more at thealexjonesstore.com. And I got to tell you, this fabric, how light it is, how good it feels. I asked the folks at Bigley, can we have some dress shirts? And I sent them an example. This is even better than the shirt I bought that was similar to it. This is awesome. This shirt is so light. It's so great in the summer. Get yours now along with dozens of new designs and so much more at theolivestonestore.com.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.